Thank you for tuning in to IGH 260. Today's program, lesson number 3 of week number 19, studying Matthew chapter 19, part of a one chapter per week, 260 week, 5-year long study of the New Testament. As we begin, these reminders. To access our materials, just click the word free at internationalgospelhour.com. For a list of our materials, just email free at ighradio.com. For updates, text IGHFREE to 55222. That's text IGHFREE to 55222. To study God's Word, use our free self-paced online study program. To start now, go to igh.worldbibleschool.org or click the online courses link at internationalgospelhour.com. To study by mail, call toll-free 1-855-IGH-6988 for a free 30-lesson series, or use the contact form at internationalgospelhour.com. A point of clarification before we continue today's broadcast. In our last program, we started our verse-by-verse, thought-by-thought study of Matthew 19. Accordingly, we started with the first verse of the chapter, noting 3 distinct transitions in that verse: a change in time and end of Jesus' 4th major discourse, and a change in place. Concerning that last change, we noted that Jesus moved from Galilee to the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. As we explained that third change in more detail, we observed that the level of testings, trials, and challenges to Jesus would become more intense as Jesus headed toward Jerusalem. While that's true, we need to note that the area often referred to as the region of Judea beyond the Jordan, or Transjordan, was, though south of Galilee, where Jesus' ministry had been centered to this point, was still not in what many would consider Judea proper. It was called beyond the Jordan, or Transjordan, because it referred to the land on the eastern side of the Jordan River. And yes, it's true that the designation Transjordan, depending on where the writer stood, could apply to either side of the Jordan River. Here, it refers to that land on the eastern side that was inherited by the 2.5 tribes of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh during Joshua's day. See, for example, Numbers 34, verses 14 and 15, and Joshua chapter 12, verse 6. It was also sometimes known as Gilead in Old Testament times, see Joshua 22:9, and as Perea in New Testament times. So, though named Judea, or the region of Judea, in this context, Jesus was not, at this point in his ministry, in Jerusalem or in the area usually identified to be Judea. He was, though, moving in that direction. He went from Galilee to this region beyond the Jordan, and then eventually to Judea proper and Jerusalem. Let's return to our study of Matthew 19. As our last program ended, we were discussing Matthew 19:3. The Pharisees came testing Jesus with a question about divorce. If you have been keeping up with our broadcasts, you know this question, this test about divorce, was not a one-off occurrence. We reviewed several of their past challenges in Matthew already up to this point. In this study, we reviewed just a few more before we continue. The Pharisees demanded more signs from Jesus in Matthew 12:38, as if what Jesus had already done, his miracles and his teachings, were insufficient to convince them that, at least, he was more than just another man. They asked for more signs again in Matthew chapter 16, verse 1 and following. In the opening verses of Matthew 15, the Pharisees came to Jesus, troubled that the disciples violated the hand-washing tradition of their elders. And now, in this context, the Pharisees were testing Jesus one more time. That's just a quick summation of Pharisaic challenges up to this point in Matthew. As we continue reading and studying through Matthew, we will learn of more. You can see then why Jesus warned the apostles about the leaven, about the doctrine of the Pharisees, in Matthew 16, verses 11 and 12. The challenging question in this context, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? questions are often asked to learn more, or to make sure that the one who asked the question has a clearer understanding of some teaching. They are, or they can be, part of the normal give-and-take dialogue that takes place every day. But, as we have seen in the brief summation a moment ago, the nature of these questions was more deceptive. It was part of the planning process by which the Pharisees could charge Jesus with a punishable offense. Moreover, as we saw when we surveyed their previous challenges of Jesus, it was the primary means by which they could justifiably, from their perspective, have Jesus put to death. There's a history behind this question. In fact, there's a history behind all of the questions that the Pharisees asked. For example, when the Pharisees objected to the disciples gathering grain and then eating it as they walked through the fields, that objection was based on the tradition, the historical tradition of the Jewish elders. We have noted this before, but as a reminder, it's important that we mention it once again. According to the tradition of the elders, what God revealed to and through Moses was only partially recorded in the Torah, the first five books of the First Testament. And again, according to the tradition of the elders, some of what was revealed to Moses that was not recorded in the Torah was orally passed down through generations. And then, much later, that oral material was recorded, was written down by the rabbis. This tradition was known either as halakha, literally the way to walk, or in written form as the Mishnah, meaning to study by repetition. The Mishnah combined with the Gemara, what might best be described as commentary or explanation of the Mishnah, together they make up the Talmud. The Mishnah, as we know it, first appeared roughly two centuries after the time of the Christ. The Talmud, including the Mishnah and the Gemara, was compiled even later. Though all of these rabbinic writings were not known until centuries after the time that Jesus lived, they were, according to tradition, rooted in the very words spoken by God to Moses 1,500 years before the Christ. Before going any further, we must re-emphasize that these traditions, regardless of how old they might be, and regardless of the claims that they originated in what God spoke to Moses, those things not recorded in the Torah, the law, are just that, tradition. We have already noted that Jesus took the religious leaders to task about adhering more to their traditions than to what God revealed through Moses in the law. They not only raised their traditions to the level of the Mosaic law, Jesus declared that they elevated them above the law. Hear the words of Jesus. He answered and said to them, "Why do you also transgress the commandment of God because of your tradition?" Matthew 15:3. And then, three verses later, "Thus you have made the commandment of God of no effect by your tradition." Matthew 15:6. At the heart of this discussion, this controversy, was what Moses said in Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 1. That verse reads, "When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house." The most debated aspect of this passage revolved around the meaning of the words, "found some uncleanness in her." As Wilkins summarized it, Moses' commandment about the divorce certificate was usually interpreted in one of two very distinct ways. Note, Wilkins and other writers often use the word indecent or unchaste in some form to reflect the word uncleanness in this translation. The Mishnah tractate records the differing interpretations. The more conservative school of Shammai held to the letter of the Mosaic law and said that the word indecent means unchastity. The more liberal school of Hillel interpreted indecency to mean that he may divorce her even if she spoiled a dish for him. The esteemed Rabbi Akiba, who belonged to the school of Hillel, later added, "even if he found another fairer than she," demonstrating that divorce was being granted for the most superficial reasons. End of citation. Very broadly, the issue was whether or not God allowed divorce for any reason. Those who opposed it unilaterally might cite Malachi's statement that God hates divorce, Malachi 2:16, and then those who allowed it were confronted with the conflict just noted. Did Moses intend divorce based only on marital unfaithfulness? Or did Moses intend divorce for just any reason? The Pharisees, by asking this question with the lead in, "Is it lawful?" were hoping to force Jesus to make a choice. The choices, from their perspective, were limited to Shammai's conservative choice, divorce only for infidelity, or Hillel's more liberal alternative, divorce for almost any reason. That "is it lawful" introduction was used in Matthew chapter 12, verse 10, about healing on the Sabbath day. "And behold, there was a man who had a withered hand. And they asked him, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" Why was that question asked? That they might accuse him. Please observe that the issue was not just getting Jesus to answer the question and to declare what the law said. The objective was to get him to answer in a way that gave the Pharisees some reason that they might accuse him. We see that same motivation here in Matthew chapter 19, verse 1. The Pharisees were not just asking, they were testing. Later, in Matthew 22, verse 17, the same words were used again. "Tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" The setup in this context, much more elaborate than the other two instances, shows just how intent the Pharisees were in getting Jesus to say something worthy of punishment. Here's the fuller context. "Then the Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him in his talk. And they sent to him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God in truth, nor do you care about anyone, for you do not regard the person of man. Tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" That's Matthew chapter 22, verses 15 through 17. Do you see the Pharisees' intent? They plotted to entangle Jesus. They sent some of their disciples with the Herodians. They used smooth language. "You are true, and you teach truth." They appealed to their perception of Jesus' independence. "You do not care for anyone. You do not regard anyone." And then finally, the real test. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? In our next broadcast, we will take up at this point and continue our study of Matthew 19. As we close, this reminder. To start a free, self-paced online Bible study, go to igh.worldbibleschool.org. We hope that you can join us as we study God's Word together in our next broadcast.